Kilauges, she decides. Something broke in Kilauges. Something between them. Something within. And now sanity is abandoning them, drip by lucid drip. There's a new rule of the slog, and even though it has never been spoken, my Mara knows with utter certainty that violators will be punished as lethally as all the others. A rule that ensuites no mention shall be made of the madness slowly possessing them. No questions, no doubters on the slog. The extraordinary thing about insanity, she has come to realize, is the way it seems so normal. When she thinks of the way the droning days simply drop into their crazed evening bacchanals, nothing strikes her as strange. Nothing visceral, anyway. Things that should make her shudder, like the nip of Cleric's nail as his finger roams the inside of her cheek, are not but of a greater elation, as unremarkable as any other foundation stone. It is only when she steps back and reflects that the madness stares her plain in the eye. "He's killing you," the thing called Soma had said. "The non-man." She finds herself drifting to the rear of their scattered mob and approaching sorrow, thinking that someone wholly broken might know something about the cracks now riddling their souls. According to the old wizard, the sergeant has known Lord Cossiter since the Unification Wars. A long time, as far as life is measured by scalpers. Perhaps he can decipher the skin spy's riddle. "The slog of slogs," she says lamely, not knowing where to begin with a madman. "Eh, Sorrel?" The others have long since abandoned him to his crazed musings. No one dares glance at him, for fear of sparking some kind of rambling tirade. For weeks she has expected, and a couple of times even hoped, that the captain would silence him. But no matter how long his harsh voice rattles on into the night, nothing is done. Nothing is said. Sarl, it seems, is the lone exception to the rules.
"She talks to me," he says, staring off to her right, as if she were a phantasm that had plagued his ruminations too long to be directly addressed. "The second most beautiful thing."
He was easily one of the most wrinkled men she had ever seen when she first saw him. Now his skin is as creased as knotted linen. His tunic is rotted to rags. His hauberk swings unfastened from his knob shoulders. And his kilt has somehow lost its backside, bearing withered buttocks to open daylight. "Tell me, Sergeant, how long have you known the captain?"
"The captain?"
The hoary old man wags a finger, shaking his head in cackling reproach.
"The captain, is it? There's no explanation for the likes of him. He's not of this world."
She flinches at the volume of his voice, reflexively lowers her own tone to compensate.
"How so?"
He shudders with silent laughter.
"Sometimes souls get mixed up. Sometimes the dead bounce. Sometimes old men awaken behind the eyes of babes. Sometimes wolves..."
"What are you saying?"
"Don't cross him,"
he rasps with something like conspiratorial glee.
"Hee hee! Oh, no, girl, never cross him."
"But he's such a friendly fellow," my Mara cries. He catches her joke but seems to entirely miss the humor. So much of his laughter possesses the dull hollow of reflex. More and more he seems to make the sound of laughter without laughing at all. And suddenly she can feel it, the lie that has been burrowing through all of them, like a grub that devours meaning and leaves only motions. Laughter without humor. Breath without taste. Words said in certain sequences to silence. Words unsaid. Words that must never be said. Her whole life she has lived some kind of lie. Her whole life she has charted her course about some contradiction, knowing yet not knowing, and erring time and again. But this lie is different. This lie somehow eludes the pain of those other lies.
This lie carves the world along more beautiful joints. This lie is bliss. She needs only look to the others to see they know this with the same deathless certainty. Even Sorrel, who had long since fled the world's teeth, content to trade fancy for mad fancy, seems to understand that something false is happening. And Cleric, how did you fall in with him? There's something about the sergeant's presence that wins her. His gait is at once vigorous and wide, his arms swinging out like a skinny man pretending to be fat.
Found him, he says.
Found him? How? Where?
Mischief twinkles in his gaze.
Found him like a coin in the dirt.
But where? How?
After we took Carathusa when they disbanded the Eastern Zaldunyani. They sent us north to Honorio.
Sent you? Who sent you?
The Ministrate. The Holies. Stack skinnies, they said. All the bills and keep the gold. They don't care about the gold, the Holies. Just stay on the southeastern marches of Galeoth, they said.
Nowhere else?
No, no. Just there.
This confuses her. She has always thought that scalpers were volunteers.
But what about Cleric, she presses. In Cariol.
Found him! He explodes with a phlegmatic roar. Like a coin in the dirt!
More eyes have turned to them, and suddenly she feels conspicuous, even guilty in a strange way. Aside from other madmen, only thieves trade jokes with madmen. As a way of playing them, even the old wizard watches her with a quizzical squint. Simply talking to the man has compromised her, she realizes. The others now know she's seeking something. The captain knows. The slog of slogs, she says lamely. They'll sing songs across the three seas, Sergeant.
Think on it. The Psalm of the Skin-Eaters.
The old man begins weeping, as though overwhelmed by the charity of her self-serving words.
Sit you, bless you, girl.
He coughs, staring at her with bleary, blinking eyes. For some reason, he has started limping, as if his body has broken with his heart. Suddenly he smiles in his furrow-faced way, his eyes becoming little more than deeper perforations in his red-creased face.
It's been lonely,
he croaks through rotted teeth. They see the plume of dust shortly after breaking camp. It rises chalk-wide and vertical before being drawn into a monstrous spectral wing by the wind. The plains pile to the north in desiccated sheets, some crumpled, others bent into stumps and low horns. The plumb line of the horizon has been raised and buckled, meaning some time will pass before the authors of the plume become visible. So they continue traveling with a wary eye to the north. Maimara hears Galeon and Paquus muttering about Shrank. The company has yet to encounter any since crossing into the Istuli, so it stands to reason. The plume waxes and wanes according to unseen terrain, but grows ever nearer. The captain barks no instructions, even when the first of the specks appear crawling across the back of a distant knoll. Hands held against the spiking sun, they peer into the distance. Riders. Some 40 or 50 of them. Just enough to defend themselves against a single clan of skinnies. A motley assemblage of caste menials, wearing crude hauberks of splint, over stained tunics of blue and gold. Their beards hang to their waists, sway to the canter of their ponies. They ride beneath a standard she has never seen before, though she recognizes the checkered black shields of Nangaelsa.
Nangaels! She says aloud. They're Tidoni.
The wizard hushes her with an angry glance. The great ordeal, she realizes. At long last they have crawled into its mighty shadow. A kind of trembling anticipation suffuses her, as if she has stumbled into the gaze of something monstrous with power. And she wonders when she became terrified of her stepfather, when for so long he seemed the only sane voice, the only understanding soul.
A lost patrol? Galien asks. Supply cohort,
Zungas says with authority. They must have abandoned their wains. Even though they can see the approaching riders discussing and debating them, the skin-eaters remain silent. They have outrun civilization, these men, so far and for so long, they no longer need fatuous words to bind them. The Nungale commander is a greybeard with a long, craggy face and a low, prominent brow. His left arm hangs in a sling. The captain gestures for Galien to accompany him. The two men walk out several paces to greet the nearing man. The aging officer does them the courtesy of dismounting, as do the two riders nearest him. But his eyes linger on Cleric for several heartbeats. He does not like the looks of him.
"To hear Hassa, Brininosh, Befel,"
the officer calls.
"Tell him we don't speak gibberish,"
the captain instructs the former columnary. Maimara looks to the old wizard, suddenly afraid. He wags his head almost imperceptibly, as if warning her against anything rash.
"Manwatir Sheyani,"
Galien calls back. The Nangales are sunburned and travel-worn, their kilts frayed, the lines of their faces inked in sweat-blackened dust. But the contrast between them and their companions horrifies Maimara. The scalper's clothing has been reduced to black rags, waxy with filth. Conger's tunic has all but disintegrated into shags of foul string. They look like things that should shamble, like things dead. The officer comes to a halt before the two men. He is Tidoni tall, but stooped with years, so that he seems of a height with Lord Cossiter. The captain seems more shade than man in his presence.
"Who are you?"
he asks impassible Sheik.
"Skin-eaters,"
Galien says simply.
"Scalpers? This far? How is that possible?"
"The skinnies were mobbing. We had no choice but to flee northwest." A moment of canny blankness dulls the officer's eyes.
"Unlikely?"
"Yes," the captain says. He pulls his knife, thrusts it into the man's eye socket.
"Unlikely."
The body slumps forward. Cries rifle the arid sky, and somehow Maimara knows the commander was beloved. The men to either side of the officer stumble back in horror. Lord Cossiter glares and grins, his knife braced against his right thigh. His eyes shine above the tangled fury of his teeth and beard. Weapons are drawn in the clamor. Beneath shouts of alarm and outrage, a different voice strums the strings of a different world. Cleric is singing. He stands pale and bare-chested. Brilliance glares through the apertures of his face. He reaches out, his hands crooked into empty claws. Lariats of white light scribble across the rear of the ragtag column. The seventh Kuyan theorem, or something resembling it. Shrieks, both equine and human, the glimpse of shadows in high sunlight. Men are thrown. Horses roll and thrash, kicking up clouds of dust. Maimara sees a man on his knees, screaming. At first he's little more than a shadow in the dust. But by some miracle a tunnel of clarity opens through the sheets. He howls, his beard aflame beneath scalded cheeks. Then the battle crashes over her. Nangale war cries rack the air. The nearest Tidoni kick their ponies forward. Shields braced, broadswords swinging high. The scalpers meet their charge with eerie calm. They step around the hurtling forms, hacking riders, stringing horses. Paquas leaps, pivoting to the weight of his great tulwar. A pony blunders into exploding dust. A rider's head spins high, then falls, trailing its beard like a comet. Zongus ducks between charging Tidoni, gores a thigh. The captain draws another in an elusive half-circle before lunging high to pierce the man's throat. The wretch falls backward, is dragged choking from his right stirrup. Chaos and obscurity. Figures emerge, then vanish into the tan fog. Sorcerous light flickers and glows, like lightning in clouds. An injured Nangale lurches out of the curtain madness, a cudgel raised in a bloody fist.
My Mara is astonished to find squirrel in her hand, bright and sharp. His face is blank with mortal determination. He swings at her, but she easily ducks to one side, scores the inside of his forearm to the bone. He roars and wheels, his beard pendulous for blood. But the cudgel slips from his hand. She has cut him to the tendon. He leaps to tackle, but again she is too nimble. She steps aside, brings squirrel flashing down, chops the back of his neck. He drops like a nerveless sack. The clamor fades. The dust is drawn up and out like milk spilled into a stream. The scalpers stand in what should have been gasping disbelief, but more resembles blinking curiosity. The fog clears, revealing chalked figures crawling or riding across the parched grasses. They have tar for blood. My Mara gazes at the man she has killed. He lies motionless on his stomach, blinking as he suffocates. The tattoo of a small circumflex graces his left temple. She cannot bring herself to end his suffering the way the others do. She turns away, blinking at the dusk, looking for a commune. She finds him several paces from Cole, who stands exactly as he had before the battle began, his sword still hanging from a string that creases his forehead. She tries to secure the wizard's gaze, but he's peering somewhere beyond her, squinting into the distance. "No," a commune croaks, as though jarred from a profound stupor. "No!" At first my Mara thinks he refers to the murder of innocents before them. But then she realizes that his gaze follows the escaping riders. She can scarce see them for the dust. Some 8 or 9 men, riding hard for the north. "No!" Gnostic words rumble out from all directions, as if spoken with the sky's own lungs. Bluish light flares from the wizard's eyes and mouth. Meaning. Unholy meaning. He steps out into the open sky, climbing across spectral ground. Wild, hoary, old, he seems a doll of rags flung high against the distance. She stands dumbstruck, watches as he gains on the fleeing horsemen, then rains brilliant destruction down upon them. Dust steams and plumes, the mark of tumult on the horizon. The others scarce seem interested. A quick glance reveals that almost all of them are intact, save for Conger, who sits in the dust grimacing, his hands clutched about a crimson welling knee. He watches his captain approach with dull horror. The shadow of Lord Cossiter's sword hangs across his face for a breathless heartbeat. Then Conger is no more. "No limpers," the captain grates, his eyes once starved and bright. And that is the sum of their plunder. It seems sacrilege for some reason to don the possessions of others, things so clean they can only be filthy. The old wizard returns on weary foot, framed by seething curtains of smoke. He has set the plains afire. "I'm damned already," is all he says in reply to my Mara's look. He stares at the ground and says nothing for the next 3 days. His continuing silence does not trouble her so much as her own indifference to it. She understands well enough. In running down the Tidoni, the old wizard has murdered in the name of rank speculation. But she knows his guilt and turmoil are just a matter of going through the motions, as is her compassion. His silence is the silence of falsehood, and as such, she sees no reason why she should care. She has the weight of her own murder to bear. The morning of the third day passes like any other, save that the tributaries they cross have all dried to dust, and their skins have grown flabby enough for the captain to institute rationing. When the old wizard finally chooses to speak, he does so without spit.
"Have you ever seen Kellis with it?"
Kellis, hearing the name pricks her for some reason. So much she resists the urge to make one of the signs of warding she has learned in the brothel. Before a commune, she never heard anyone refer to her stepfather in the familiar before. Not even her mother, who always referred to him as your father.
Not once. "Seen my stepfather?" she asked. "You mean with my other eyes?"
She can tell by his hesitation that this is a question he had feared to ask for a long time.
"Yes."
"Absolution," she realizes. "He killed the Tidoni to prevent any word of their expedition from reaching the great ordeal. Now he seeks to absolve himself of their deaths through the righteousness of his cause. Men murder and men excuse. For most, the connection is utterly seamless. Those killed simply have to be guilty. Otherwise, why would they be dead? But Akamian, she knows, is one of those rare men who continually stumble over the seams in their thought. Men for whom nothing is simple.
"No," she replies.
"You must believe me when I tell you I have only seen him a handful of occasions. Prophets have scarce the time for real daughters, let alone the likes of me." This is true. For most of her years on the Endymion Heights, the Aspect Emperor was scarce more than a dread rumor, an unseen presence that sent hordes of perfumed functionaries scurrying this way and that through the galleries. And in a manner, she realizes with a peculiar numbness, very little has changed. Was he not the hidden tyrant of this very expedition? For the first time, it seems, she sees things through Drusus Akamian's eyes, a world bound to the machinations of an Asarimber Kellis. Looking out, she has a sudden sense of loads borne and stresses diffused, as if the world were a wheel spoked with mountains, rimmed with seas, one so vast that the axle lay perpetually over the horizon, perpetually unseen. Armies march, priests tally contributions, ships leave and ships arrive, emissaries howl in protest and wriggle on their bellies, all at the pleasure of the Holy Aspect Emperor. This is the world the old wizard sees, the world that frames his every decision, a singular thing, a living thing, nourished by the arteries of trade, bound by the sinew of fear and faith, a leviathan with a black cancer for a heart.
"I believe you," he says after a time. "I was just wondering."
She ponders this image of the Aspect Emperor and his power, this hellish seal. It reminds her of the great Nilnameshi mandala that hangs in the Elysium Forum, below the Endymion Heights. For more than 1,000 years, artisan sages of Invishi sought to capture creation in various symbolic schemes, resulting in tapestries of unparalleled beauty and manufacture. The Elysium mandala, her mother had told her once, was famed for being the first to use concentric circles instead of nested squares to represent the hierarchies of existence. It was also notorious for containing no image whatsoever in its center, the place typically reserved for the god of gods. Innovations that, her mother explained, saw the artisans stoned to death. Now my Mara sees a mandala of her own manufacture in her soul's eye, one more temporal than cosmological, but every bit as subversive in its implications. She sees the million-paneled extremities, the tiny lives of the mob, each enclosed in ignorance and distraction. And she sees the larger chambers of the great factions, far more powerful, but just as oblivious given their perpetual scramble for prestige and dominance. With terrifying clarity she sees it, apprehends it, a symbolic world thronging with life, yet devoid of nerves, utterly senseless to the malignancy crouched in their absent heart. A dark world, one battling a war long lost. As thin as her passions have become, it seems she can feel it. The impotence, the desolation, the gaping sense of hopelessness. She walks for a time, tasting, even savoring, the possibility, as if doom were a kind of honey cake, a world where the Aspect Emperor is evil. And then she realizes that the opposite could just as easily be true. "What would you have thought," she asks the old wizard, "if I had told you he was wreathed in glory when I saw him, that he was, without any doubt, the Son of Heaven?" "This is it," she realizes, "the rat that hides in the gut, gnawing and gnawing. Hard questions, girl. You have a talent for them." The overthrowing fear. "Yes, but the dilemmas remain yours, don't they?" He glares at her, and for the merest heartbeat, she glimpses hatred. But like so much else, it drops away without residue. Simply another passion too greased with irrelevance to be clutched in the hands of the present. "Strange," he replies distantly. "I see two sets of footprints behind me." There is this sense of unraveling, a sense of threads worn and abraded until snipped by their own tension, a sense of things hanging, as if they were nothing more than fluff skipping across the wind. A sense of things tying, of newborn anchors, novel tautnesses, yanked across old seams, old straps, as if they were spiderwebs become kites, soaring high and free, batted by falcon winds, pinned to the earth by a singular string. Kiri. Kiri the holy. Kiri the pure. Each night they queue before the non-man, suck from the teat that is his finger. Sometimes he clasps their cheek with his free hand, gazing long and melancholy into their eyes, while his finger probes their tongue, their gums and teeth. And it is right and proper to taste the spittle of another. They have found a new tusk to guide them, a new god to compel their hearts and to bend their knees. Kiri, as rationed and apportioned by its prophet, in Kerriol. During the day they walk, utterly absorbed in the blessed monotony. Like beetles, they walk with their faces to the earth, step after step, watching their boots hooking through the halos of dust. During the night they listen to Cleric and his incoherent declarations, and it seems they grasp a logic that binds disjointed absurdities into profound holes. They revel in a clarity indistinguishable from confusion, an enlightenment devoid of claim, or truth, or hope. And the plains pass like a dream. "The Kiri," she finally manages to blurt. "It's beginning to frighten me." The wizard's silence has the character of a breach. She senses his alarm, the effort of will it takes for him to stifle his rebuke. She knows the words warring for control of his voice, because they are the same words that continue to nag and accuse the corners of her thought. "Fool, why throw stones at wolves? Everything is as it must be. Everything will turn out fine."
"How so?" he says coldly.
"In the brothel,"
she hears herself reply, and is amazed because she is usually so loath to speak of the place.
"Some of the girls, the ones who broke, mostly, they would feed them opium, force them. Within weeks they would...
"Do whatever they needed to get more," the wizard says dully. Trudging silence, coughing from somewhere ahead of them.
"Could that be what the non-man is doing to us?"
Speaking this question is like rolling a great stone from her chest. How could it be so difficult to stand square in the light of what was happening? "Why?" the wizard asks. "Has he been making demands?"
"No," she answers. "Not yet."
He ponders the ground, his stride, and the resulting exhalations of dust. "We have nothing to fear, my Mara," he finally says, but there is something false in his manner, as if he were a frightened boy borrowing the assured tone and posture of a priest. "We're not the same as the others. We understand the dangers."
She does not know how to reply, so she simply continues pacing the wizard in silent turmoil.
Yes, something cries within her. Yes, we know the danger. We can take precautions, refuse the Kyrie any time we wish. Any time.
Just not now. Besides, he eventually continues, we need it. She has anticipated this objection.
But we've traveled so far, so fast already.
Why so harsh? A voice, her voice, chides her. Let the man speak at the very least. Look at the stone hags, he replies. Men bred for the slog, eaten up in a matter of weeks. How well do you think an old man and a woman would fare?
Let the others go ahead, then. Or even better, we could steal away in the heart of the night.
Or best of all, it occurs to her, just take the non-man's pouch.
Yes, steal it.
This makes so much sparkling sense to her that she almost laughs out loud, even as a more sober part of her realizes that one does not take anything from a Kuya mage. Ever. As quick as her smile leaps to her lips, her eyes tear in frustration. No, the old wizard is saying, there is no breaking the covenant we've struck with these men. They would hunt us down, and well they should, given what they've sacrificed. He is warming to the ingenuity of his rationalizations. As is she.
Maybe we should comfort Cleric, she offers. Drag the issue before the whole company.
Even as she utters this, she can feel her resolution leech away.
See? Why bother?
You never had the heart for this. Akamian shakes his head as if a truth, so old and fat it cannot but be weary. I don't trust Galien. I fear Kyrie is the only thing keeping him here.
Let him leave, then.
Her shrug is directed more toward her words than the man, it seems. If Galien leaves, Akamian replies, his self-assurance relentless now, he will take Pakwas and Zongus with him. We need Zongus. To eat, as much to find our way. Though they smile at each other, their gazes are too slicked with apprehension to truly lock. And so it ends, a conversation that began so real, it sent burning coals skidding through her gut, become a pantomime, a shadow play of numbing words and self-serving reasons. As she had hoped all along. They walk, the nine, their backs bent to an exhaustion only the remaining stone hag can feel. Maimara actually cries, softly, so that the others cannot hear above the wind batting their ears. She sobs, once, twice. So profound is her relief. Her thighs blush and her mouth waters at the thought of the coming darkness. And of the soot smudged across the tip of Cleric's white finger. There is a vastness to the wind on the nocturnal plain, a sense of heaven-spanning enormities, one drawn roughly across the other. All things are seized, all things are lifted and bent, and when the gusts are violent enough, all things kneel, or are broken. She has crept from the others into the night. Gusts scour the ground, galloping like the outriders of an infinite horde. She turns her face away from the prick of flying sand, gazes without surprise at herself, wearing the tattered rags that had once belonged to Soma. It seems she has known she would find it here, waiting, the consult skin spy. The company had continued marching past dusk, stopping only when they found the protection of a meager depression. She set out the way she always set out, instinctively choosing the line of sight and wind most favorable to a stalking predator. And found one.
How?
She hisses. There is something frantic within her, something that would fly into pieces were it not for her skin.
How is the non-man killing us?
The thing mimics her crouching posture. It seems at once harmless, nothing more than an image without depth, a mere reflection, and as deadly as a bolt cocked in a ballista. Fear tickles her, but she feels it with a stranger's skin.
Tell me.
It smiles with the same condensation she has felt across her face innumerable times.
one both beautiful and infuriating.
"Yokore," it says with her voice. "Give it to me and I can save you."
"What?" She clasps the pouch where it hangs between her breasts. "No, no more games. Tell me how." Her vehemence surprises both of them. She watches her eyes click to the darkness of the camp behind her, her face imperceptibly bent to the needs of a sharper ear. Then she hears it herself, the mutter of sorcery, effortlessly stepping around the buffeting wind, climbing up out of the substance of dust and earth.
"The Kiri?" the other her says, the other spy. "Ask him what it is."
Then the thing is gone, leaping high and deep into the darkness, and running like no human can run. Yanking her head about, my Mara sees the old wizard scaling the gusting heights, his eyes and mouth alight with brilliant meaning. His voice echoes deep across the angles and surfaces of a different plane. Lines of blinding light needle the dark, curving trails of white across the plain. She glimpses fire and exploding earth, swaths of ground clawed into black by the shadow of grasses. She glimpses herself running with gazelle beauty, leaping with serpentine grace. Then the spewing dust sweeps up to obscure him, and so secure his escape. Kull, the last of the stone hags. She stares at him while the wizard rails at her.
"What? What were you doing so far away?"
The man sits hunched, the only one not watching her and her father. He was a large man, a powerful man, when they had rescued the surviving stone hags and the mop. Now he is scarce more than a knob-jointed rack. He has long ceased caring about his war knot, so his hair falls in mats about his face and shoulders. Whatever armor he possessed he has lost to the trail, and were it not for the captain, he would have cast away his broadsword as well, she imagines. His beard is matted with grime, making a sphincter of his mouth, which hangs perpetually open. His eyes stare down, always down, but even still they possess the glint of desperation.
"It just came to me," she lies, for in truth she came to it. "It had my face. You could have been killed. Why? Why would you wander so far?"
Kull, only Kull. Of all his brother hags, only he has yet to succumb to the rigors of the trail. He is, she realizes, the last pure thing in their mad company. The measure, the cubit of their depravity. The only one who has not tasted Kiri.
"It meant to replace you!"
As she watches, the man's shaggy head jerks, as if to a gnat's sting. The bleary eyes squint and struggle, as if trying to sort shadows from the darkness. He can't see, she realizes, not because his eyes fail him, but because it is a moonless night and clouds obscure the nail of heaven. He can't see because his eyes remain human. Unlike theirs.
"Fool! Fool of a girl! It would have strangled you, stripped and replaced you!"
At last she turns to look up at the wizard. He stands with his back to the wind so the edges of him, rotted hide and tangled hair, seem to fly toward her.
"What is it?"
she asks in Einani. He blinks, and even though his fury continues to animate him, she somehow knows that a kernel of him simply does not care, that a hunger lies bald like a greased marble in his soul, waiting for the watches to pass and for the pouch to be drawn again.
"What is what?"
he cries. He is troubled, she knows, because she has spoken in Einani, the tongue of their conspiracy.
"I'm talking to you, girl."
In the periphery she can see the hoary aspect of the captain, his hair and cast noble braid lashing the air above his right shoulder, his eyes as bright as Selokaran steel. His knife slumbers in its scabbard, hanging high on his girdle. But she sees its curve glint above his blood-stained knuckles nonetheless.
"Nothing," she says to the wizard, knowing that he does not know.
"Kiri is Kiri.
The desire that forever slips the leash of your knowing, the hunger that leaves no trace in your trammeled soul." "Water before food," Songus says to them. They walk in an undeviating line now that their water skins are empty. Nothing can be more simple, it seems, than walking straight across never-ending flatness. And yet all is turmoil and confusion. Not the kind that quickens hearts or wrings hands, but the kind that simply hangs like a chrysalis in her soul, suspended, motionless. Everything, it seems, her voice, her scissoring step, her expression, is as assured as it has ever been, save that the world they confront has become a dream. Everything possesses a nagging likeness, the colors, the maroon swirls of different weeds drying and dying, the patches of sienna dust, the black of some recent grass fire, the swagger of the land piling without height, as if some god had poured mud atop mud just to watch the edges spread over the horizon. The drama of the sky, the clouds climbing in ranges, here tangled into luxuriant locks, there swept up and around in a snowy melange of wings. A kind of disbelief plagues everything she sees, as if existence were foam, and the world nothing more than a titanic bubble. What was happening?
"You have the look," a voice gurgles from behind.
She turns and sees teeth and gums, eyes pinched into besotted creases. Sorrel, somehow shadowy, though all the world is bright, looking like a filthy gnome.
"You have the look, aye."
She can hear Flem snap in his cackle. The peril of speaking to madmen, she realizes, is that it permits them to speak to you.
"Don't dispute me, girl. It's true. You have the look of a path long mutted. Am I wrong?" "Am I? Tell me, girl. How many men have marched across your thighs?"
She should hate him for saying this, but she lacks the inner wind. When has feeling become an effort? Many fools, but men? Very few.
"So you admit it!"
She smiles out of some coquettish reflex, thinking she might use his carnal interest to learn more about Lord Cossiter. "What am I admitting?" The grin drops from his face, enough for her to glimpse a sliver of his bloodshot eyes. He leans close with a kind of wonder. Too close. She fairly gags at his buzzing reek.
"She burned a city for you, didn't she?"
"Who?" she replies numbly.
"Your mother. The Holy Empress."
"No," she laughs in faux astonishment, "but I appreciate the compliment." Sara laughs and nods in turn, his eyes once again squeezed into invisibility. Laughs and nods, trailing ever farther behind her. What was happening? She is not who she is. She is already two women, each estranged from the other. There is Maimara who knows, who watches the old motives, the old bonds, gradually disintegrate. And there is the Maimara who has gathered all the old concerns and set them in a circle about an unspeakable pit. She is already two women, but she needs only touch her bowing abdomen to become three. They laugh at her for all the food she eats. More and more she is ravenous come evening. She chides the wizard for loitering when he should be preparing the humble field cants he uses to cook their spoiling game. She scolds Zongus when he fails to secure them enough game. Whatever speech they possess leaks away as the sun draws down the horizon. They sit in the dust, their beards lacquered with grease, the entrails of their victims humming with flies. Vultures circle them. They sit and they wait for rising darkness, for the melodious toll of Cleric's first words.
"I remember."
They gather before him. Some come crawling, while others shuffle, kicking up ghostly trails of dust that the wind whips into quick oblivion.
"I remember coming down from high mountains and treating with mannish kings."
He sits cross-legged, his forearms extended across his knees, his head hanging from his shoulders.
"I remember seducing wives, healing infant princes."
Stars smoke the arch of heaven, paint the nunman's slouching form in strokes of silver and white.
I remember laughing at the superstitions of your priests.
He rolls his head from side to side, as if the shadow he cradles possesses hands that caress his cheeks.
I remember frightening the fools among you with my questions and astounding the wise with my answers. I remember cracking the shields of your warriors, shattering arms of bronze.
And it seems they hear distant horns, the thunder of hosts charging, clashing.
I remember the tribute you gave to me, the gold, the jewels, the babes that you laid at my sandaled feet.
A hush.
I remember the love you bore me, the hatred and the envy.
He raises his head, blinking as if yanked from a dream inhumanly cruel for its bliss. Veins of silver fork across his cheeks. Tears.
You die so easily, he cries, howls, as if human frailty were the one true outrage.
He sobs, bows his head once more. His voice rises as if from a pit.
And I never forget.
One of the scalpers moans in carnal frustration. Galien.
I never forget the dead.
And then he is standing, drawn like a puppet by invisible strings. The holy dispensation is about to begin. Strange shouts crease and crumble the windy silence, like the yelping of leashed dogs. She can see hunger leaning in their avid eyes. She can see manly restraint give way to clutched arms and rocking gesticulations. And she does not know when this happened, how awaiting the pouch had become a carnival of fanatic declarations, or how licking a smudged fingertip had become carnal penetration. She sits rigid and estranged, watching Cleric, yes, but watching his pouch even more. As meager as their rations are, scarce enough to blacken the crescent of a pared fingernail, she wonders how long they have before the purse fails them altogether. Finally he towers before her, his bare chest shining with hooks of light and shadow, his outstretched finger glistening about the nub of precious black. She cannot move.
My Mara,
the Ishroy asks, remembering her name. He calls to both of herselves, the one who knows but does not care, and the one who cares but does not know. But for once, it is the third incarnation that answers.
No, it says. Get that poison away from me.
Cleric gazes at her for a solemn moment, long enough for the others to set aside their singular hunger. There is horror in the wizard's look. Lord Incariel gazes at her, his eyes watery white about coin-sized pupils.
My Mara.
She repeats herself, finding new wind in her unaccountable resolution.
No!
Desire, she has come to understand, is not the only bottomless thing. There is motherhood. She dreams that an absence binds her, a hole that claws at her very substance. Something is missing, something more precious than jewels or celebrated works, more sustaining than drink or love or even breath. Something wonderful that she has betrayed. Then she is gasping, swallowing its sour consciousness, and blinking at the visage of Incariel leaning over her. She does not panic, for everything seems reasonable.
What are you doing? She coughs.
Watching you.
Yes, but why?
Even as she asks this, she realizes that only sorcery, subtle sorcery, could have made this visitation possible. She thinks she can even sense it, or at the very least guess its outlines, the warping of the wizard's incipient wards. It was as if he had simply bent the circumference of a Commian's conjuring, pressed into his arcane defenses, as if they were no more than a half-filled bladder.
You, the flawless face said, you remind me of someone, I think.
There is something old about his reply. Not dead nation old, but doddering old. Frail. What is it? She asks. She does not know where this question comes from, nor which traitor gives voice to it.
I no longer remember,
he replies with a grave whisper.
No, the Kyrie. Tell me what it is.
The wizard murmurs and stirs beside her. Cleric stares at her with ancient, ancient eyes. The nail of heaven traces a perfect white sickle along the outer rim of his brow and skull. He has a smell she cannot identify, a deep smell, utterly unlike the human reek of the wizard or the scalpers, the rot that softens stone.
Not all of my kind are buried.
Some, the greatest, we burn like you. And she understands that she has been asking the wrong question. The wrong question all along. Not what, but who.
Who? She gasps.
Suddenly his hand is all that exists, heavy with power, gentle with love. Her eyes track its flying path to his hip, to the rune-stitched pouch.
Taste, he murmurs in tones of distant thunder. Taste and see.
She can feel the weight of him, the corded strength, hanging above her, and a part of her dreams. She is naked and shivering. His finger lowers toward her, pointing to something that cannot be seen. She leans back her head, parts her lips. She closes her eyes. She can taste her breath, moist and hot, passing from her. The finger is hard and cold. She closes the pliant lobes of her mouth about it, warming and wetting its stubborn white skin. It comes alive, pressing down the center of her tongue, tracing the line of her gums. It tastes of strength and dead fire. In the corner of her eye, she glimpses the captain through overlapping lattices of dead grass, a wraith watching. Above her, Cleric's face dissolves into a porcelain blur. Relief tunnels like lightning through her, swelling the slack hollows about her heart, flushing her extremities. Thin clouds race overhead, black trimmed in starlight, swept into the shapes of wings and scythes. They lend the illumination of surface across the infinite plummet of heaven, like froth drawn along a stream. He draws his finger back, and a reflex rises within her. She clamps her lips about his knuckle, ticks the tip between her teeth, pad and nail. Her tongue soaks whatever residue remains. He places his hand across her face, thumb against her chin, fingers along her jaw and cheek. He withdraws the penetrating finger slowly, rolling down her lower lip. The nail of heaven gleams along its glazed edges. He stands in a single motion, at once swift and utterly soundless. She cannot tear her eyes from him, nor can she smother the longing that wells through her. So profound the ground itself seems to move. Her mouth tastes of ash and soot and glory. Glory everlasting. The old wizard walked. Once, while traveling between Atrempus and Aeocnissus, he saw a child of no more than 10 summers fall from the willow he had climbed in the hope of stealing honey from a great hive. The child broke his neck, died in his father's arms, mouthing inaudible words. Another time, while walking the endless paddies of the Sekarib, he saw a woman accused of witchcraft stoned to death. They had bound her with rose wicks, so that her struggles scored her skin. Then they cast stone after laughing stone until she was little more than a crimson worm writhing through the mud her bleeding had conjured from the dust. And once on the road between Sumna and Momun, he camped at the ruins of Badathent, and in the cool of morning glimpsed the shadow of fate cast across the first holy war. Adversity lay in all directions, the Nilnameshi were fond of saying. A man need only walk. I know what it is, Maimara said from his side. The sun spiked his eyes when he turned to her. Even when he squinted and raised his hand, it framed her with fiery white, blackened her with encircling brilliance. She is a shadow, a judging shadow.
The Kiri, her silhouette continued. I know what it is.
An angel of the sun delivering tidings of woe. What is it? He asked, but not because he cared. He had outrun all caring.
Ashes, she almost whispered. Ashes from the pyre.
Something in this stirred him, as if she had kicked a long-gutted fire and discovered coals. Deep burning coals.
Ashes?
Who?
He slowed, allowing her to outrun the sun's glare. He blinked at the immobility of her expression.
Kujara Kimwa, I think.
A name drawn from the root of history. There was nothing to say, so he turned to the trackless world before them. Great flocks of term rose like steam from the far-ranging folds of dust and grasses. The plains. They passed like a dream.